It's always a pleasure to speak at the Mises Institute. I regard myself as a lonely soldier on the remote outpost of literature for the sake of Austrian economics. I'm always on the lookout of something in my field that might be relevant to Austrian economics. And I hope I found a subject today, namely copyright. This is a subject that has been of great interest to Austrian economics in recent years. I myself have been persuaded by the people who are opposed to intellectual property. I don't propose to go into the issue, but just to suggest how literary studies can actually help us in this area. It's surprising how much good material is available on copyright. I brought along several books if people are interested in seeing them. Literature professors do study books. They study the history of the book. And a lot of good stuff has been written, at least on the history of copyright, without necessarily taking a position against it. These books are very revealing. By going back to 1600, they show that copyright is a creation of the state from the beginning, that for at least two centuries, copyright solely existed for the benefit of publishers and not at all for authors, and above all, that copyright was a system of licensing. Kings used it to determine what would and would not be published within their realm and to reward their favorites. Again, it's a long history. I won't attempt to go into it. It is interesting that it's only in the 18th century that copyright begins to be available to authors, and it really is in the 19th century that the current sort of cultural theories behind copyright emerged. And there's a lot of interesting scholarship on that subject. And there's overwhelming evidence that our modern notion of what an author is a product of the Romantic period and Romantic ideology. And that's why I'm going to focus today on the figure of William Wordsworth. Now, when I was studying Romanticism in graduate school, I never expected to make this sentence, but here goes. William Wordsworth was the Mickey Mouse of the 19th century. That is, you may have noticed that whenever Mickey Mouse threatens to come into the public domain, miraculously Congress decides to extend copyright. And it turns out Wordsworth was the first example of this. This is what I was amazed to discover, that really the first parliamentary debate in England about extending copyright. It was at the time 14 to 28 years, and then in 1842 it was expanded to 42 years, or the author's lifetime plus 7 years, whichever was longer. The debate over that copyright extension, the major act of copyright extension in the 19th century, really the first time Parliament devoted itself specifically to the issue of the length of copyright, was fought over William Wordsworth. A man named Sergeant Thomas Noon Tailford, member of Parliament from Reading, and a minor author, single-handedly raised the issue of copyright. It began in 1837. Parliament moved slowly. It wasn't until 1842 that the extension of copyright was passed. He was a great admirer of Wordsworth, had written about him, and indeed enlisted him in the cause. So this is a very interesting example of how we are reliving stories from the 19th century. When you go back, you see once again that the rhetoric of copyright extension was built around celebrating a great author and how much he needed money and how his children were going to go impoverished if his copyright wasn't extended and so on. So it's a very interesting case study in seeing what, at least how copyright is sold to legislative bodies and in the realm of public opinion. Now, as it turns out, it was not just a campaign on behalf of Wordsworth, but he was enlisted in it very actively. He had wrote some 40 to 50 letters. Some appeared under his own name in newspapers in defense of this copyright extension. Some appeared anonymously. as if there was this huge groundswell in favor of the copyright extension. Moreover, he lobbied individual members of parliament, including Sir Robert Peel, and it didn't get any higher in those days than Sir Robert Peel. He's, after all, the guy that carried the anti-corn law legislation. Wordsworth said he wouldn't organize a petition, but he'd happy to be to sign one, and a number of other authors signed, Charles Dickens, Robert Browning, Harriet Martineau. But Wordsworth was the only one who was actively engaged in this. The others were willing to sign petitions. But moreover, it's quite evident that Tailford's arguments made in Parliament were very much derived from Wordsworth. But Wordsworth went even beyond this. He wrote a sonnet in favor of copyright. Now, this is what I figure I can really contribute to you. You guys probably never dreamed a sonnet was ever written in favor of copyright. But here goes. This was written in May 1838 as the campaign was revving up in Parliament. It's called A Plea for Authors. Failing impartial measure to dispense to every suitor, equity is lame. And social justice, just think what Hayek would have thought, social justice being raised here, and social justice stripped of reverence for natural rights, a mockery and a shame, law but a servile dupe of false pretense, if guarding grossest things from common claim, now and forever she, to works that came from mind and spirit, grudge a short-lived fence. That's what a 28-year copyright is. It's a short-lived fence. What? Lengthened privilege, a lineal tie for books? Yes, heartless ones. Or be it proved that 'tis a fault in us to have lived and loved like others, with like temporal hopes to die, no public harm that genius from a course be turned and streams of truth dried up even at their source. Not the greatest sonnet ever written, I will tell you. If that wasn't enough, though, Wordsworth really turned on the rhetoric and wrote another sonnet, A Plea to His Grandchild, sequel to A Plea for Authors. This is very hard to follow, so I'll say basically saying, I can't believe my grandchild will be so poor, because I don't have copyrights, that he'll be dumb and can't even read my books. Here it goes. Son of my buried son, see, that's grandchild. Son of my buried son, while thus thy hand is clasping mine, it saddens me to think how want may press thee down, and with thee sink thy children left unfit through vain demand of culture, even to feel or understand my simplest lay that to their memory may cling. Hard fate, which haply need not be, did justice mold the statutes of the land. A book, time cherished, and an honored name are high rewards, but bound they nature's claim or reason's? No. Hope spun in timid line from out the bosom of a modest home, extend through unambitious years to come, my careless little ones, for thee and thine. Again, I think this is unique in the history of the world, poetry in favor of copyright extension. By the way, Wordsworth believed in perpetual copyright, but was willing to settle for 42 years plus seven. Now, it's interesting to examine the arguments that Wordsworth and Tailford, his mouthpiece, made on behalf of the extension of copyright, because in many ways it's the inverse of the real issue of copyright. I mean, that most authors make their money in the first few months of what they publish. It's very rare to go beyond that. But Wordsworth was in a different situation, and it's something that really frustrated him. He was not selling well as a poet. He was selling decently, but he had this theory that his day would come. When Lyrical Ballads was first published, this volume he published anonymously with Samuel Taylor Coleridge, 1798, he got 30 guineas for it, guineas a pound plus a shilling. For the 1800 second edition, he got 100 pounds. tell you how stupid my colleagues are. Some of them say, gee, look how little money he got for his book, £100. Well, they've never heard of inflation or deflation. £100, it's hard to estimate. It's worth at least $20,000 today, probably more. You could live decently for £150 a year. That was a middle-class income. So Wordsworth was getting almost a year's income. I wonder if he only has to split it with Coleridge. But what annoyed him was Thomas More was getting £3,000 for Lalla Rookh, that Sir Walter Scott was getting £35,000 for some of his poems, that's billions of dollars right there. And so Wordsworth was frustrated that he wasn't doing as well in the marketplace as other poets, but he had this sense that he was truly great and they weren't, and that over time their popularity would fade and he would become more and more popular. And indeed, by the 1830s, he reports his income off his copyrights was about £1,500, which is, a lot of money in those days. By the way, he was one of the first authors to hold on to his copyrights. Most of us academics have given away our copyrights to the presses that publish our books. And it was very characteristic in those days for almost everybody to get whatever money they could from the publisher initially and let the publisher bear the risk. But Wordsworth did hold on to his copyrights, and he therefore wanted them extended and extended. And his argument was that a great poet, an original genius, creates the taste by which he is appreciated. That's why Wordsworth wrote so many prefaces to his works, trying to explain to a non-buying public how really great his poetry was. And again, it's interesting that Tailford uses that very language in the parliamentary debate. So I'm going to read you a couple of things that Wordsworth said about in defense of extending the copyright. The objections against Tailford's proposed bill rest upon the presumption that it would check the circulation of literature and by so doing would prove injurious to the public. And indeed, people who republished books, a famous one named Tegg, were arguing that copyright's long enough. By extending it, you'll keep the circulation of books down. We're the ones who do cheap reprints and make books available to people. So Wordsworth recognizes that objection. But this is what I love. This is so characteristic of the Romantic poets. But what we want in these times, and are likely to want still more, is not the circulation of books, but of good books. And above all, the production of works, the authors of which look beyond the passing day and are desirous of pleasing and instructing future generations. Now, there cannot be a question that the proposed bill would greatly strengthen such desire. A conscientious author who had a family to maintain and a prospect of descendants would regard the additional labor bestowed upon any considerable work he might have at hand in the light of an insurance of money. Copyright is insurance, kind of life insurance for authors, upon his own life for the benefit of his issue. And he would be animated in his efforts accordingly and would cheerfully undergo present privations for such future recompense. Deny it to him, and you unfeelingly leave a weight upon his spirits which must deaden his exertions, or you force him to turn his faculties, unless he is unjust to those whom both nature and law require that he should provide for, to inferior employments. So basically, it's an argument that we need copyright because otherwise people, writers, will devote themselves to the mere fads and fashions of the moment in an effort to make a quick buck. But to write a great work of literature, you need to be able to take the longer perspective, and only the assurance, he said, of perpetual copyright would permit that. Might add there, you notice he's obsessed, as we saw in that second sonnet, with his family. He really wanted a form of property. He complains poets don't own land, but they could have these perpetual copyrights that would be like a land to give to their descendants. Here's another example of what he said on behalf. This actually was years before the actual parliamentary debate. It's in 1808. He was saying, I'm told that it is proposed to expand the right from 14 years as it now stands after the decease of authors till 28. This, I think, far too short a period. At least I am sure that it requires much more than that length of time to establish the reputation of original productions, both in philosophy and poetry, and to bring them consequently into such circulation that the authors in the persons of their heirs or posterity, there it is again, can in any degree be benefited. I mean in a pecuniary point of view, for the trouble they must have taken to produce the works. The law, as it now stands, merely consults the interest of the useful drudges in literature or of flimsy and shallow writers whose works are upon a level with the taste and knowledge of the age, while men of real power, like Wordsworth, who go before their age, are deprived of all hope of their families being benefited for their exertions. Notice the theory here that poets need incentives to produce great work, that if they don't have a perpetual copyright, they're just not going to put into poetry what they need to produce great works. Now, this is the same Wordsworth who, in the 1800 preface to the Lyrical Ballads, defines poetry as the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings. That's his romantic theory of poetry, that's spontaneous, it just flows out of you, it's overwhelming. That is probably closer to the way he produces poetry than anything he says in these letters. It, in a way, is such a mechanical view of poetry that the poet sits down and calculates, now, should I write something suited to the moment and make a lot of money to give my family, or should I wait and be a genius? And if I have copyright, then I can afford to wait for my poetry to become famous. That's a very unromantic view of how poetry is produced. For a more romantic view of how poetry is produced, I turn to a man named Ludwig von Mises and a book called Human Action, which has some interesting discussion of copyright in it, but particularly a section called The Creative Genius, in which Mises writes, far above the millions that come and pass away tower the pioneers, the men whose deeds and ideas cut out new paths for mankind. For the pioneering genius to create is the essence of life. To live means for him to create. He goes on to say the activities of these prodigious men cannot be fully subsumed under the praxeological concept of labor. It's really quite remarkable. People who think of Mises as viewing everything in economic terms don't realize that he was able to see that there's something that goes beyond that. And I just want to read one more sentence from him, a saying about poems. They are not the outcome of the employment of labor, which could have been devoted to the production of other amenities for the production of a masterpiece or philosophy, art, literature. Poetry for Mises is indeed the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings. So I'll conclude by saying that in this debate, Ludwig von Mises is the romantic, and William Wordsworth is the narrow-minded economic thinker who talks about incentivizing and the poetic indifference curve.